Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and today I've got a very special guest with me. My guest this morning is Hugo Schechter of the Player Care Group. Morning, Hugo. How are you, mate?
I'm really good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. It's been a busy morning, but I'm sure it's going to be an insightful one as well. So, Hugo, just before we get started, maybe just share with the listeners and the guests that have been on the show before, you know, a brief insight on who you are, what you do, and we can maybe tail it off from there.
Yeah, definitely. So currently I'm founder and managing director of the Player Care Group, having been head of player care at West Ham United for 2.5 years. And before that, player liaison officer for 3.5 years at Southampton. And before that in America as team operations manager. So really varied background, but kind of focused down the player care route. I was a coach in uni and I did uni out in America and coached out there, both men's and women's football. So kind of there's not really a traditional route into player care, because I think it's one of those industries within football that's quite a low barrier to entry in terms of specific qualifications or degrees or whatever. So there's such a varied group of people working in player care in football. And by player care, I mean pretty much anything that's not football or medical around the players and their families. So player relocations, it could be commercial activations, team communication, travel with the team. You know, there's so many different things that different clubs do it very differently, but you know, there's so much going on, and being that sort of 24/7 on call, in case of emergencies, not just in case they need anything, but being there for the players and their families and trying to give them, remove all distractions so they can perform on the pitch as best they can.
Amazing. Very brief insight. So just Hugo, just you know, you mentioned there, obviously you started off as a coach.
Yeah.
You've moved into this this element of the industry. What was it that caught your eye about this aspect of things? And you know, player care is something that we're hearing more and more of, especially now with the way modern day environments are set up, especially, you know, not just in football, but in across different sports. So maybe just share a little bit of insight around, I mean, you did talk about it briefly there, in that it's anything that's not really medical or I guess technical related, if you like. Yeah. But maybe just talk about, you know, to how far that really extends itself.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, when I was younger, I was always really into football, like watched it all the time, and kind of I thought my way into football would be through coaching. I did my level one in the UK, and then I did my E and D license in the States. And I don't know, in America, I was lucky. I think because you got a British accent, you're immediately given a kudos in terms of knowing about football. So I had some nice jobs at uni and coached under 16 girls and under 23 men's, which was two vastly different experiences. And I think for me, really, it kind of shocked me how different it was, but both hugely enjoyable. But I realized that having never really been a player at any level, like even at youth football, I was never really any good enough to get picked. Probably my ceiling in terms of how good a coach I could be was limited. But what I also did while I was coaching was did all the sort of organization and, you know, all the team stuff. So I was president of the team, so I'd organize all the fundraising and all the travel and all the organization, and as well as coaching at the same time. And that was actually where I saw us getting a lot of the advantage against other teams in the area, because we were so much better organized than they were. And in terms of, you know, it was university men's in America, which is great, but it wasn't the varsity team, it was like the student run team. So when I started, we were outside the top 1,000 nationally. By the time I left, we were 24th in the nation. And like, so to go up 900 and whatever 70 places, it wasn't necessarily because we had a super talented players, but I mean, we had a good squad, but everyone knew what they were supposed to be doing. We would have meals before the games. We would arrive on time. We'd have the right number of players. And for anyone who's sort of involved in sort of recreational football, that can be half the battle, is to get, you know, your five-a-side team, if four players show up, you're not playing. So, and so that, by having a good squad traveling and everyone in the right place at the right time, and even the uniforms all being the same, you know, getting all the kit, properly done, that was something that actually we won the first battle before we got on the pitch because our guys felt really well prepared. But also, you know, we were going up against teams who were kind of just pulling guys together. And so you would see them kind of as we walked onto the field, they would be like, oh, wow, you know, like these guys are going to be good. And we always played with maximum intensity in the first 5 minutes to really kind of knock them back. And we were very, very successful through that. And I think we played the same formation every single game. We played 4-4-2. We played the same players as much as we could, not because I was unable to be tactically astute, but that wasn't my strength. My strength was that everyone knew what they were doing at the right time and had minimal distractions. And we just knew our jobs, and we knew that we could pretty much beat almost anyone that we came up against by sticking to our game plan. And so that was kind of when I realized in football that this kind of stuff can make a real impact. And if anything, it can, not having it done properly can undermine all the benefits. And so that's what I'm talking to Premier League, also not just Premier League, clubs around the world with my consulting now, is saying, you guys focus so much on the 3 hours a day of professional players at the training grounds. You've got 3 sports scientists, 5 video analysts, you've got stats, you've got nutrition, all this stuff. If a player doesn't have things off the pitch sorted, you're undermining those marginal gains you're paying a lot of money to get. So if you've got all those people, but then the player's been stuck in a hotel for 2 months since arriving, he's sharing a small bedroom with his wife and 2 kids, he's not sleeping very well, it doesn't matter, you know, that he's having whole grain pasta instead of white pasta at dinner, because he's so lost on you know, he's losing such a big chunk on the personal side that the marginal gains are lost on that other side. So that's kind of where I think that start as a coach, but really as an organizer, came into the football world. And that's kind of what I'm trying to preach to clubs now. And it's so underdeveloped in even in the Premier League, which is seen as the best league in terms of football player care. But, you know, even they are not, the clubs there are not giving it the resources they need. And you're seeing these problems again and again, where players aren't settling in the area, players are not playing well, you know, issues at home affecting their performances. And when you put that into financial terms, if you're playing someone 70 grand a week and they're taking 10 days to get into a house, that's 100 grand of their salary that you are not wasting, but you're not getting the maximum out of them. So every second counts in this kind of stuff. So for me, it's really the next big change within football. You know, we've had data analysis in the last few years has really sort of come into the fore, video analysis before that, you know, sports science, sports medicine before that. So I think this is, player care is really going to be where the industry goes the next sort of 5-10 years, hopefully.
No, I definitely agree with you. There's a lot of benefits that can come from it, but, you know, within that, there's also so many differences in terms of what is required from it. You know, you talked there very briefly about all the different clubs doing it in different ways. Mm-hmm. But also, as well as having your own different ways of doing it, you've also got to understand that every person is individually different. So I guess maybe just share some insight. You said that you spent some time with West Ham doing the player care stuff. What does that look like as a department? Is it just a one-man job? Is it one-man band for, you know, to support everyone? Do you have a team of player care liaisons, if you like?
Yeah. So at Southampton, I was by myself, and that was fine. I was the first one that they ever appointed, and it was a new role, and it grew, and you know, we grew it in 3.5 years to something, you know, really good. And then I moved to West Ham to become head of department, and they wanted me to head up a new department at West Ham. So I did that and hired 2 excellent people who had vastly different skills to myself. And I think that was really important in any team, to build, sense your own weaknesses and fill those weaknesses by excellent people that you trust. And so, you know, the team was myself, who was kind of experienced in football. My other 2 guys, they didn't come from football, and I was quite keen not to recruit someone who'd been at another club and gone, well, we do it this way, we do it that way. Like, to be honest, I'm not interested in the way that other clubs do it. I'm interested in the way that I think is right, and I think I do it differently. And so by hiring 2 keen people who were excited to learn, but also had really good life experiences, was really good. So we had a lady who joined us from women's rugby. She'd also worked in HR in a large corporation, and she was excellent at policies, procedures, organization. You know, she really drove the department in terms of sort of the, especially the administrative side. She was really, really excellent, but also a really warm person as well. And then we had another lad who was straight out of uni, languages graduate, but full of energy, you know, could speak, you know, the languages that the other two couldn't, and was, you know, running around making beds and picking up cars and all that kind of stuff. And so that between the three of us, we had a really good team where we had pretty much, I would say, all the main strengths covered. And that, I think, is an appropriate level of staffing for a Premier League club. But a lot of people kind of look at player care as this kind of concierge service, this kind of, like, you know, wiping the backsides of players. You know, and I think for me, it's kind of a lazy stereotype in terms of what we do, because, you know, at the end of the day, these guys are high performing athletes who the clubs pay a lot of money for. And just to say, well, they should sort themselves out, well, maybe or maybe not, but also put yourself in their shoes. If you were to move to Senegal age 19, would you know how to get a phone or when the bins are out or any of that? So, you know, it's that kind of stuff. And you're not also having to go under the pressure of playing in front of 60, 70,000 people every week. So it's really, I think, a tired stereotype of that, you know, it's just wiping backsides.
I think you make some great points there. I think, you know, it often does go overlooked, the fact that because maybe we're especially working senior players, they're making such large amounts of money that people forget they're actually human beings. They are still human beings. They still have the same problems that every other person might have, whether that be settling into a new environment, whether that be, you know, missing their family because they've had to move to a new country, or they're finding challenges because they're having to learn the language.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if we take a very brief example, I'm pretty sure, you know, Carlos Tevez was here for the best part of 8 years, but I don't even know if he knows fluent English yet.
Exactly. And that's ridiculous, you know, but that's a failure of the club, really.
Because... But, you know, definitely. And I feel like...
And him as well, yeah.
100%. You know, I've got one of my good mates who's a basketball player, and he's been around the world, and, you know, everywhere he went, they would have stuff set up, you know, similar to what you're talking about, you know, having someone to help him settle in, having someone, you know, set up maybe language classes and things like that for him. And I think it does go, like I said, overlooked because they are athletes who make large sums of money that, you know, they don't need the same support, or they shouldn't get some sort of support that maybe other people might do. Right. So I guess... Now, you talked there a lot about that, and I'm presuming that a lot of that is with first team players.
Yeah.
Do you have any, you know, experiences of having to maybe interact in those same ways with maybe players from the younger age group, maybe working in the academies, maybe more predominantly probably the professional development phase players?
It's very different in the academy. So academy player care and first team player care are the same name of a department, but actually, you know, it's interesting. Like I teach my course with two head of player care at academies, and, you know, learning from them, because I've never worked in the academy, to learn from them, it is a very different kettle of fish, but it still has similar principles. But I think the way I look at the differences, and I think, you know, Sue and Miguel would agree, and my tutors, is that first team player care is 80% support, 20% education. And academy is probably the inverse of that, is 80% education, 20% support. So, you know, it's not the idea that a 16-year-old player can, you know, go click his fingers and a Lamborghini's delivered. That's not player care in the academy. It's very much based on life skills development, teaching them how to do things, supporting them and making sure that they have the right resources they need, you know, protecting them as well. So there's elements of safeguarding, there's elements of education, academic and life skills. But it's very much not a first team style, which tends to be more like, let's know how we can help you, or this is how we can help you. It's, these are the curriculums, this is what we're going to do for you. And if you need help individually, you know, we're happy to in the academy. But the idea is to try and make more well-rounded players who, whether they succeed by going into the first team, or they succeed by going to another club, or they succeed in life as going into a great education or another career. And I think it's about qualifying success in terms of, success is always seen as playing in the first team 1,000 games. Well, actually, a young player who comes through and gets life skills and comes into it, you know, and starts a business is brilliant. And I think Southampton did a really nice job of highlighting the success of released scholars and the success in life they've had. There was one lad who started up a medical recruitment firm in Portsmouth. And that was seen as a bigger success as James Ward-Prowse, you know, two very different, obviously, stories. But actually, they were so proud of the lad who went and did that startup that actually, and I think that's a great message, because You know, we've seen the Panorama documentary that came out this week, you know, talking about players and you know, how tough it can be. But actually, when you're putting it on the players and their identity, that they have to be footballers, they have to be successful, it's really hard. And it is really hard when they don't reach that for them to carry on. So what we're trying to do is again, not calling it a plan B, but dual careers. So you have two pathways and you're equally happy on either. And we're equally happy for you to take either. So you have a dual career rather than a plan B. And I think even little sort of ways of referring to things can make a big difference in terms of seeing. Obviously, release is not ideal for players, and that's not what they want on the whole. But actually, seeing it as an opportunity to springboard onto something else better can be, you know, a really good message to give.
I totally agree with it. Right, so Hugo, now one of the things that you touched on there is this idea of dual career and having a dual career approach. But ultimately, the priority is obviously to produce footballers. And at the highest level. But it has been talked about more and more over the more recent years, certainly from my experience, is that a lot of clubs are really trying to put at the forefront of, rather than prioritizing a footballer, a good person, someone who can be an upstanding citizen of the community, if you like.
Yeah.
But where is the balance? Now, obviously, we want people to be, and obviously every club is different, but at what point does there start to be a conflict from, I guess, from a player care perspective of, right, how much of this we're doing to support the individual and how much we're prioritising the club's needs in producing a footballer, if you like?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive, to be honest. I think you can have good footballers who are good people. I think from my experience, to be honest, like, the top footballers always have a bit of an edge. I think a genuinely lovely footballer, I don't want to say will never make it to the top, but you need a bit of grit, a bit of nastiness, a bit of bite to you to be a top footballer. And I think, you know, you look at a lot of top people in industry, in business, in sport, whatever, they aren't necessarily considered nice. And I think, you know, whether you're talking about young player care professionals, you're talking about young footballers, I think you need to be respectful, you need to be, you know, engaging, listening to what you're being advised to do, but also you need to be able to stand on your own two feet, and you need to be able to make decisions for yourself, and you need to be able to, you know when to say no, and also sort of play the game a little bit. So I think there's a balance between creating like a well-rounded, lovely person and creating a footballer. But I think you can be a good person and still not be, you know, I don't say wet, because that seems really unfair, but you know what I mean? Like, some of the loveliest footballers I've worked with have not been the best footballers. Like, they've not been the best. And some of the best ones I work with have been really, really tough to deal with, but they were, because they're on your side and they're on your team, you're like, okay, I'll put up with him because he's really good. The problem is when they're neither. If they're not good and they're a pain in the ass, then that person's got a problem. But that's quite rare. And I think, you know, it's definitely about creating well-rounded humans and allowing them to focus. But I think this idea, again, that people need to focus on their football is a bizarre one. Like, most people in life have hobbies, and footballers are not working 40, 50 hour weeks. They're working 3-4 hours a day on the whole. You know, in the academy, they work more. But it's really important, I think, for them to have interests outside of football. Interest that they can enjoy, something that they can switch off. And I know, you know, this kind of the fan adage of you know, you lose 5-0 away and they shouldn't be given any days off, they should be training. Well, I know that if I've had a bad day at work, the last thing I want to do is do more work. I want to switch off, maybe have a glass of wine, maybe watch some TV, go for, you know, do whatever. I don't want to go and just do more work, because actually you need a break to refresh, you know. And I think, again, there's this kind of human side of football that is often forgotten. And I think the more and more these fixtures are pushed, you know, there's more and more fixtures, more and more competitions, the more and more burnout you're going to see of players. I think you'll see players who retire earlier. I think you'll see players who end up skipping various competitions or whatever, because it just gets too much. And certainly, even though I wasn't playing, I went to every game, home and away, for 8 years. And I was completely burnt out at the end of it. I did 400 and something games. I don't watch football anymore. I don't enjoy the game. You know, and I used to love it. And now I'll probably watch 20 minutes of football every week. You know, I would say is how much I watch. If it's one of my teams are on and that I've worked on and it's on TV and I'm not doing anything, I'll stick it on for a bit. But I don't, you know, I'm not really that bothered. And I think you also see more and more players who don't like football in the sense that we would put it on the bus. You know, we'd have, you know, our bus is a really nice bus. Obviously, when you travel to games, got TVs there and everything. We'd always have the game on. I would say maybe less than a third would watch the actual match. Most of them would be playing cards, playing PlayStation, talking to each other, reading a book, playing chess, whatever it is. Obviously, when a goal goes in, everyone looks now, oh, okay, wow. But actually going, wow, this, you know, really want to do this. And I think that's a shame because you've got players, and there are definitely players who still love the game, but there are a lot of players who are like, listen, I do this because it's great money and I'm good at it and I enjoy it, but I'm not desperate to watch every second of every game. And I think that's an interesting sort of point to notice.
And I can totally relate. I mean, I guess it's almost having an overload, isn't it? I mean, with anything, whether it's obviously in this case it's football, you're talking about players, but the way I look at it is, you know, I don't want to do something that's my job, and I do that as a, you know, for argument's sake, a 9 to 5. I don't want to then go home and talk about or study my 9 to 5.
Yeah,
let me keep that work there and let me do everything else elsewhere. But something that really kind of jumped out at me while you were talking there was, as coaches, I think we'd all love to have great relationships with our players. Now, I guess in a role like yours, would it be fair to say that maybe you spend probably a lot more time with that individual than maybe the coach does?
Yeah.
So I guess in that then, do you find that, and I know you obviously mentioned there's some people that are going to be difficult to work with and you're going to get that in life. Do you find that maybe a lot of your work ends up in you forming friendships with these people?
Not really. I mean, like, okay. Yes and no, I would say. I think at Southampton, if I'm being critical of myself, I was young. I was 23 when I started. I got too friendly with people. I think also because I was living in a city, I didn't know anyone. And so I was seeing people from work. So like, you know, if you move to a new city for work, you go out with colleagues for a meal or to hang out or for coffee, whatever. And I did that with staff and players. But I think what I realized is that it made my job difficult in the fact that I'm a club employee and I have to be on the club side. And it's a very difficult balance to get where you are respecting you're supporting the players, but also you are ultimately a club employee. And I think that one of the hardest times I've had is when a club and a player are fighting and I'm caught in the middle of it. Because the player's like, I thought you were my mate. And I'm like, well, I am, but I work for the club. I'm going to lose my job if I don't do this properly. So when I joined West Ham, I made it very clear to people that I was there to be a professional. I was warm, I was empathetic, and I was helpful, but I was not friends with anyone until they left the club. And if they want, either were they or obviously I have as well now, but was very clear. I never went for a single drink with any person from the club. I never went for dinner. I think the only time I met one assistant kit man once on my first week, and that was it. Like in literally in 3.5 years, I took my team out, but that was it. And I think that made you stronger because you have a work life and you have a personal life and they're disconnected. And I was never afraid to advocate for players' rights or for an issue that I thought with the player. And especially with David Moyes, he really bought into what I was doing. And so I had a great relationship with him where I could say, this is coming up. This is why this is maybe the anniversary of his father's death. This is, you know, a tough week for him. And he'd be like, great, you know, thanks for letting me know, whatever. Or even if it's his birthday, make sure you say, you know, happy birthday. But to have that, be able to have feedback to the manager like that was really important. But, you know, it's really important not to become friends and not to cross that line. But also, like, sometimes you do say to the player, like, listen, I'm going to tell you this. I shouldn't tell you this, but you know, this is what I'm going to say to try and build that relationship. And you've got to have that balance of what you know is important and not important, and run that gauntlet a little bit. But you know, I left with very good relationships with everybody or nearly everybody, and that's not by becoming overly friendly. And I think managers sometimes need that distance as well to be able to make hard decisions, because you know, especially Premier League manager, has such hard decisions to make that if he's overly friendly or overly close, then is he making the impartial decision or is he making one that he feels bad about or whatever? So I think it's a really difficult balance to find.
I think it's a great point. It makes me think back to a time when I was working with a senior team a few years back, and there was a few social events. Maybe it might have been someone's birthday or something, and they actually asked me if I was going to come, and I was straight to the point, nah, I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be there. But actually, one of my assistants would go. And I had a great relationship with the players, but I just felt if I step into that realm, certainly while I'm still, I guess, managing them at that time, it can blur lines. So there was a level of respect there. I would say that we had a good, strong relationship, but I wouldn't class it as a friendship. But there was open communication. We had, you know, basically all the qualities that a friendship may have without it being labeled as one. And I think that's also an important piece in that, because I would assume that in your process of developing these relationships and building these relationships with the people that you're working with and that you're supporting, a lot of that stuff is likely, you know, very much resemble that of a friend, but without having the label attached to it. How important do you think is that label's not attached to it, but maybe the behaviours are somewhat the same, if you like?
Yeah, I think it was really weird because when I left Southampton, I didn't have a long notice period, a month's notice period, and they didn't replace me for like 9 months. So it was because they were, I don't know exactly the reasons, but I think they were worried about relegation and getting new staff and all this kind of stuff in. So I'd been at West Ham for maybe a month, and I got a message from one of the players saying, my tenancy agreement's coming to an end. I haven't got a place to live. You know, I'm done next week. Can you come down and help me find a house? And I'm like, no, I work for a rival club. Like, I can't do that. That's, you know, you need to speak to the club. And they're like, I'll pay you. And I was like, it's not about the money. It's like, this is a conflict of interest. I'm working at a rival club. And, you know, I'm sorry that Southampton haven't replaced me, but that's not my problem. And he was like, I thought we were mates. And you're like, but you do know I was paid to be there. You know, like you do realize that this was my job. And like, yes, I care about you and I care about your family. And I knew a lot about them. I would go to birthday parties and I still speak to some of them and their wives and all this. And like, it's great to follow their journeys. But like, I was like, but it's my job. And so, you know, you're trying to say, well, yeah, I'm here as a friend, but I don't want to say a paid friend because that sounds terrible, but like I do genuinely care. I genuinely do care, but it's also my job. And so there are times when I will not be able to give you everything because I've got other priorities, but also for them to know that in a real emergency, I would always be there for them as both a professional in my job and then, you know, as a friend later on. So yeah, it's really tough, but I think that's where those blurred lines and that crossed thing that you talked about, and that's where it kind of came back to bite me a little bit, where people thought that I was just, you know, how could I leave them? How could I do that? And I'm like, well, this is a much better opportunity for me. I was a head of department, you know, I was living in London. I was managing a team of people. I had to do it. And I'm glad I did. But it was that kind of like personal heartbreak where you're like, well, I thought we were friends. But, you know, I think, you know, it's on the other side as well. It can be difficult. And I remember the first player that moved away that I got really close to him and his family was Morgan Schneiderlin. And I'd see Morgan every day. I'd help him with all this different stuff, you know, him being French, but he was quite established in the team. And we would talk every day, you know, multiple times every day. And then he went to Man United and suddenly like talked very little, like not like because I did anything, but like, it was just, he didn't need me anymore. And I didn't need, there's nothing really to say to him. And, you know, by the time he was at Everton, like, you know, we'd say hello on the match days and stuff, but really.
And yeah, you know, that there was individual players that I'd worked with who, you know, on the other side had got such a close relationship when I was at Southampton. And like Morgan Schneiderlin was the first one I remember really like I would see him every day and you know, work with him very, very closely, and, you know, considered him a friend, I guess. But then once he left Man United, there was no need for either of us to really talk to each other on a regular basis. And so we kind of drifted apart, but actually it was like, oh, like, you know, it's almost like a breakup or something like that, where you're like, you know, you're used to speaking to someone every day and then being around the, you know, I go help him with the shopping, I'm with other bits, and I got to know his partner and all this kind of stuff. And then suddenly it was like, oh, I saw him like twice a year at games, home and away. And then it, again, when he went to Everton, even less. And now, like, I don't think I've spoken to him in a number of years. And it's not because either of us are not interested. It's just that's the way football is. And I think football's such a transient industry. I've worked with 140 players in my career. How many am I actually in touch with still? Maybe like 20, I would say. So 120 people that I've been very involved in their lives, who I have had no contact with for years. And that's just football. I mean, but I think it's also like business. You know, if you work in a work environment, how many people in the office do you actually keep in touch with? 5 or 6, you know, probably. So I think in terms of football, it's not that different. But you go from being so involved in someone's life to completely not. And that, I think, is hard for both sides, really.
No, definitely. I can appreciate that. As you're going through it, I think. So did you feel like maybe there were some withdrawal symptoms at some point where you wanted to reach out to these people in some ways?
I don't think I could say I'm addicted to Mortgage Island. But, you know, I don't think that. No, I think, you know, I like, you know, the good thing about social media is you can keep in touch. You can keep kind of tabs on people. And, you know, like I it's cool for me to see, like, you know, when I not was there for the birth of a baby, but, you know, like helped a player get his house ready for a baby being brought home. And then you see them now and they're 7, 8 years old, kicking the ball around the pitch with their dad, you know, after a game. That's really cool. Cause you're just like, well, you know, it's really nice to see how that family's kind of grown and done that. So, you know, and there was obviously certain players who have gone on to real footballing successes as well. But again, to the earlier point of that kind of celebrating all sorts of success, there were some guys who I worked with. I was an intern in the under 18s at Southampton before I went there full time. And some of them are just killing it. Like, you know, one's in America, just done his masters, you know, working out there. Brilliant. You know, that's so cool to keep in touch with him and just see how he's doing. So yeah, I think, you know, there are certain, obviously going to be people at work that you like more than others. And there are some footballers that I enjoy staying in touch with, but the majority it's, you know, I think anyone who's worked in football knows this kind of football conversation at a game where it's, oh, how are you doing, mate? Yeah, good to see you. How's the family? Yeah, family's good. Oh, I see you next year. Yeah, see you next year. And that's literally what you end up doing with 85. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's, I'm very fortunate to have friends outside of football. And so I, you know, I don't feel the need to sort of be best mates with a lot of players. But, you know, ultimately doing the job you do, you often fall into that.
No, I totally appreciate that. There's some great insights there. You know, I'm also conscious of time, so I want to kind of maybe get some real nitty gritty for the listeners and the viewers. How does one get into player care?
Mm-hmm.
And what would you say for maybe those people who are looking to adopt a player care approach, if you like, in their environments where maybe it might not be a first team at a Premier League club, it might even be a grassroots club. What are some of the things that maybe tangible things that they could maybe take away from what a player care department would do in that sort of environment and maybe apply in their own environments? What would you say are, I think you've talked in brief about some of the benefits of having a player care department and what that offers, but maybe what that would look like in maybe potentially a grassroots setting or in a college or, you know, even in an academy setting, if you like.
Yeah, I'm going to answer your second question first, but I think it's player care is not just about spending money. And actually the best bits of player care is the things you do for free or for very little money. So, you know, one thing I always recommend to organizations is do like a photo sheet of players, like of everyone who works around the club. If you're getting a new player, whether it's into your school or into your men's team or whatever, or women's team, it's here's a picture of everyone's names and faces, and we'll give that to you before you start. And you can carry that around on your phone or on a piece of paper. And so when you're speaking to someone, you go, oh, okay, look at that. Okay, that's Steve. Okay, cool. Oh, I know Steve now. Because it's nothing worse than starting a new environment and someone talks to you and you're like, oh, I can't remember his name. Or so you need to introduce yourself to someone. You're like, I don't know his name either. You know, and so that's something that can be done in an hour. You know, take a picture of each person, put their name on a sheet and maybe their role as well. But done, you know, and that's something that I would say to any club, and that makes such a massive, massive difference. But it's even just asking how people are, making sure that everything's clearly organized and, you know, okay, you know, where's training? Okay, well, is there a weird way to get into it? I went to watch my friends play and they said, here's the address of the pitch. And I was like, great. The game kicked off at 10 a.m. or whatever. I got there at 9:45 and I couldn't find my way into the pitch. It was a pitch in the middle of the South London, but for some reason you had to walk all the way around and then come in this back gate and all this. And I spent 45 minutes trying to get, and I was like, this is mad. I count myself as quite a switched on person, but I could not find my way in. Now, had they said, enter on this street and come through the gate there, it would have saved me 45 minutes of stress. Now, imagine I was making my debut for that team.
Yeah.
And I'm then 45 minutes late because someone hasn't put in
one line through the roof.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing where I was just going to watch. So it doesn't matter that I was late, but like, I was annoyed because I was like, this is a waste of my time. And I was about to like leave and then I worked out. But actually, like, imagine that's your player or that's you, you know, you're the partner of the player. You know, they've come to watch their partner for the first time and they can't be in the off. You know, it's little things like that where just put yourself in the other person's shoes of how they're feeling.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of getting into the industry, I think...
Can I just hold you there for a second before you move on to that? Just on that note, though, I think that it's a word that you've used consistently through this conversation, is that word organized and being organized. Maybe before we move on to that next question, then maybe just share a little bit more insight in terms of what that actually means. Because initially it started off by being organized when you was out in the States and you're the way you was organizing the team. But what does that actually look like? Because people think organized is just always either or. It's either on the pitch or not necessarily just off the pitch, but the vibe I get from what you're saying and the way you've spoken about it is like across the board, you're making sure that basically all the T's were crossed and all the I's were dotted.
Yeah.
And there was nothing left to interpretation. It was just like, no, this is black and white here. Everyone has a clear understanding of what's going on, what the processes are, how things are done, where to go for this, where to go for that. Maybe just share a bit of insight on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I slightly deviate from what you've said in terms of, for me, good organization is the appropriate release of information to the right people at the right time in a way they can understand it. So there's no point having something organized 3 months in advance and you tell everyone, right, in 3 months, you've got to come in this gate at this time and then never speak to them again. And they're like, well, it's organized. I told you 3 months ago. Yeah, but that's not how the world works. So, and for me, especially when I was, you know, basically running the organization of West Ham's first team, is there are so many needs of different people who need to know different timings, different schedules at different times. So the groundsman and the security guys need to know what time they need to get the pitch ready and open the gates. The caterers need to know what time, the chef, he would kill me if I said caterer. The chef would need to know when to get the food ready for, you know, any dietary requirements, all about that. You know, the kit man needs to know when he needs to put the kit out, who's going to be training, is it young players, is it first players, is it injured player, you know, who's going to be there. And so, and the players need to know what time they need to show up, what time the gym will be open, what time pre-activation is, what time all this. And so the idea is that you put it, everything in a format that gives the right people the right information at the right time in a way they can understand it. And a lot of what I think player care is getting lots of information and digesting it into ways that people can understand. So, for example, like during COVID, the prime minister's and the government's advice was convoluted, but it was very, very wordy. There was a lot of information that as players, they didn't need to know, but there was bits that were changing daily. So we would do like 3 bullet points every couple of days. This is the latest rules, whatever. And so it wasn't like, here's a link to the government website, read it yourself, because I knew they wouldn't do it. So it's basically, do not go outside. You can't go to restaurants, whatever, until 20th of May, whenever it was. And obviously it would change a lot. So then they were getting frustrated as well. But again, we had this issue before where you know, stuff would be organized months in advance. And if you don't remind them, you know, a month away, 2 weeks away, a week away, 3 days away, 1 day away, they'll just forget and they won't show up, because they're not used to dealing with calendars and spreadsheets and all this kind of stuff. But that for me is good organization. It's not about having every sort of possible scenario thought about. It's being able to adapt and solve problems. Absolutely, crisis management, problem solving, but making sure everyone knows what they need to be doing at the right time and not overloading the information. So yeah, I think that's what I would say organization is.
Awesome. Now you're about to go into letting everyone know, I guess, how they could potentially get into the player care industry.
Yeah, I think the first thing you want to do is you've got to be empathetic towards people and you've got to care about people. And, you know, obviously kind of biased. I run courses in player care, and it's my company, the Player Care Group. We run these online courses, and it's not necessarily for people who want to get into player care. It is, and it has been, and we've got a number of people working at clubs now, but it's for people who want to learn more about player care. So we get a lot of business owners, we've had coaches, we've had estate agents, we've had, you know, young aspiring professionals as well, teachers who want to learn more about player care, either for their own knowledge to input into their own industry or to try and find a job. So that's obviously a great way to do it. However, the course is new, and, you know, we've had what, 85 people through six sold out cohorts. Great. But majority of people working in first team roles in the Premier League, well, 19 of them have not done the course and one of them has. So for me, it's about volunteering at your local level. It's about trying to find something where you can add a difference. And just because you haven't got experience in it doesn't mean you can't do it. Like, if I look at the backgrounds of player care professionals, Premier League, you've got policemen, ex-military, you've got teachers, you've got ex-players, you've got linguists, you've got all these different people from different backgrounds. So use your individual life story or life experiences to show how you can be a problem solver. You can be someone who can find solutions to problems, who can be empathetic and warm and really support these guys. And, you know, look out for opportunities, because they're hugely competitive. But I'm always happy to talk to young people who are looking, or not even young people. The average age of our course is like 40. Anyone who is interested in doing player care, I'm happy to sort of on LinkedIn to reach out and try and help if I can.
Amazing. And just on that then, as we look to wrap up, are you on social media as well? Is it, and how would they get access to your courses exactly? Where could they go to get access to your courses?
Yeah.
Is it an open entry thing?
Yeah. So at the moment, it's first come, first served. So we've got the next cohort starts in November, but I think it'll be sold out by the time this goes out. We've got more in February as well. But playercaregroup.co.uk, at playercaregroup, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and I'm at Hugo Schechter on the same platform. So yeah, plenty of ways. Like, you Google player care, you'll find me. I'm pretty high up on Google for player care. So yeah, you shouldn't be a problem to get a hold of me. And happy to talk to you, show you more about the course and about what you're trying to do and try and help.
Amazing, Hugo. Look, it's been very insightful. I'm sure we could talk for hours about all the stories you've got and your connection with Morgan Schneider then.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been a fascinating conversation. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that are looking to maybe potentially look into your course and maybe have some questions for you. So hopefully they'll be getting in touch. They'll probably let me know if they've got any thoughts on the episode as well. But Hugo, Thank you again for your time today. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you reaching out. And, really enjoyed the conversation.
Amazing.